have laws on the books prohibiting dog fighting. Dog fighting is a federal crime. Let me say that again. Dog fighting is a federal crime. And yet, animal welfare officials report that dog fighting is more popular today than ever. Shame. 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 Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, are often at stake in the breeding, the training, and the selling of fighting dogs.
Fighting is a federal crime. It is. Too bad the CIA, FBI, and police torturers aren't treated in the same way and don't have that same regard of torture being a federal crime. And then you say dog fighting is more popular today than ever, but so is waterboarding and sensory deprivation of human beings, especially for people who are Middle East descent. Then you go on to say, how sadistic, two dogs placed in a pit, turned on one another. Now most people with their moral compasses set straight don't deny dog fighting is barbaric. But here's the problem I and many slaves like me have. Where was and is this strong moral foundation against inhumane actions and allegiance when you, Representative Robert Byrd from Virginia, joined the Ku Klux Klan? Where was this mighty dissent speech then? Where were the cries against the sadistic characters and actions of you and your fellow Klansmen gouging out the eyes, cutting off the testicles, making postcards of your lynched black victims, breaking the body parts and selling them in jars and dime stores in your neighborhoods? Never mind. This is America. Hypocrisy knows no bounds. You know what the hell time it is. Slave time. Check this. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 freakradio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz, 104.1 Berkeley, 96.3 Antelope Valley, 106.7. Check out savagejustice.blogspot.com, propagandapress.org, the partners in revolutionary agenda in South America. And of course, radioforall.net, the universe. Tonight, we're going to deal with some bonding of black athletes in the American experiment. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3, Slave Revolt.
Wrong. Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
Public outrage over the Barry Bonds steroid controversy and the Michael Vick dogfighting scandal says more about the American public and its perception management on violence, law-breaking, lack of morality than the two persons in question. The racialized elite class identifying attacks exposes the hypocrisy and brutality of this sick American experiment. In his Ruins of Empire segment called The Barry Bonding of Black Athletes, Michael Vick, Barry Bonds, and the Politics of Negotiated Outrage in America, we're about to explore this classic American scam. A scam that shows just how deep down the rabbit hole much of the populace in this American society is in. Michael Vick, pro football player, quarterback, Atlanta Falcons, has been involved in the barbaric treatment of dogs. PETA, average Americanos, have screamed in outrage. Ban Vick for life from football is one of the outcries, amongst others. Now, of course, slave revolt isn't excusing such sick, barbaric acts that are epidemic in this country, by the way. But is Vick the only one? And what is the response, if any, when others partake in this brutal treatment for their own diabolical purposes of defenseless animals?
One of them is a man named James Mitchell, another somebody named Bruce Jessen. There are other names that have been bandied about, but I don't feel comfortable mentioning them. But they were people who had, again, advised on SEER techniques, and so they knew a lot about the psychological steps people go through when they're being tortured, and they knew that their expertise was in resistance, how to resist torture, and so what happened was they wound up being asked, well, how do we get these hardened Al-Qaeda figures to stop resisting? They believed or talked at least a lot about a program called Learned Helplessness, which is a psychological theory that springs out of experiments done on animals, particularly on dogs, where they were subjected to so many electric shocks in so many kind of random ways that at a certain point the dogs just gave up trying to escape from the pen, even though the entrance was open. And they talked about these psychologists talked about how you need to break resistance in the Al-Qaeda figures. At least this is according to people that I've interviewed. The psychologist, I should say, James Mitchell, has denied that he was trying to apply learned helplessness to the Al-Qaeda figures, but others who were in the room with him describe him talking about it incessantly, trying to break them down to a point where they stopped trying to resist.
So once again, here you have this U.S. wretched government involved in a form of psychological analysis to break down human beings in a form of learned helplessness through the acts of torture. But one of the byproducts of using these methods and learning how to engage and institute these methods is to use defenseless dogs, defenseless animals. Now, this is the U.S. government engaged in this torturing of animals so that they become so traumatized by the electroshock torturing that they engage in, that they end up being involved in a form of learned helplessness where they don't even try to escape when they can because they've been so brutalized. But nowhere do you really see any real outcry from much of the Americano population on this type of barbaric act. Because in many ways, this system is designed to break the real will and spirit of the masses of people through a form of learned helplessness. Now, what ends up happening is when the state apparatus is brutalizing people. And when the state apparatus is brutalizing animals, the sorry Americano population that is so indoctrinated in a form of learned indifference, learned deference, learn allegiance to the elite authority, has nothing really to say out loud. There's no hysteria like you see in other issues that follow in a similar vein, but are the appropriate target to act out on. So by this behavior-modified Mike Vick is the monster populist game, shouldn't the CIA know better than to electroshock helpless, defenseless dogs into compliance? A compliance of demoralized helplessness? Where's their moral foundation? Where's the attack on the CIA? But once again, much of the American population has been put into a mind state and an allegiance and a relationship of learned helplessness, learned allegiance, learned indifference to the rulers at hand. Now, I'm not even mentioning that the overall program is designed, in essence, to torture human beings, like Arab people, in this sick, barbaric war on terror, which is just a war on segments of the humanity. But for many Americanos, well, Arabs are not really human either, so I guess it doesn't matter. And I don't even need to go into the long-standing torture case that has been going on for decades now, and is still going on, concerning John Birch in the Area 2 prison, a jail facility in Chicago, for the torture and barbaric human massacres that have gone on there through electroshock torture. But never mind, we know black folks aren't real humans either. So once again, you see a learned indifference. Even a reporter who reported on the case of the Area 2 torturing going on by that has gone on by John Birch has said, look, it's not that much of the public doesn't know. It's just that much of the public is apathetic towards who is being tortured, mainly black men. That's the reality. From Abu Ghraib to Abu, Area 2 in Chicago, the learned apathy remains the same. And as a matter of fact, the barbaric acts of Mike Vick and his dogfighting buddies has created more outrage than the documented torture memos of the Boy George administration written by John Yoo and James Bibby.
If you take a look at the so-called torture memos, the 40 pages or so of memos that were written by Jay Bibby and John Yoo way back right after 9/11, and you take a look at how they're busy looking at the Convention Against Torture, basically, it seems, trying to figure a way around it. One of the things they argue, these lawyers from the Justice Department, is that if you don't intend to torture someone, if your intention is not just to inflict terrible pain on them, but to get information, then you really can't be necessarily convicted of torture. So how do you prove that your intent is pure? Well, one of the things they suggest is if you consult with experts who will say that what you're doing is just interrogation, then that might also be a good legal defense. And so one of the roles that these seer psychologists played was a legal role. They were the experts who were consulted in order to argue that the program was not a program of torture. They were there to say, we've got PhDs, and this is standard psychology, and this is a legitimate way to question people.
Now, basically, these are just slobs looking for ways to skirt around torture by using legalese, legal defense measures, throwing psychologists in the mix. Also, they try to document that if the president says it's not torture, then it's not torture. These are barbarians. but there's a selective outrage against selective groups within this population that you see these types of issues hit the fore. A while back, Corcoran Prison, there was what was called cockfighting. This was constructed by the prison guards, where the prison guards would intentionally pit prisoners against one another and then take bets on who would win. So there you get the name cockfighting. In other words, they were dehumanizing them like you would dehumanize a species of chickens into cockfights or dogs into dogfights. After the prisoners would brutalize themselves for a while, then the prison guards would shout out, quit. And just that instance after saying quit, they would start shooting. This often ended up coming into the death of prisoners. When one prison guard decided he was going to give up some of the information of this barbaric treatment, he was derided for snitching on fellow prison guards and was chased in a car by prison guard authorities after him. Because, see, some snitching is not acceptable if it's against certain elements of authority. So, once again, this type of dehumanization and barbaric acts is epidemic. But it's very selective when and who the population blares its fangs at. Now we have dog chew toys of Michael Vick. You know, little toys that look like Michael Vick that dogs can chew on. T-shirts that say stick Vick in the pit and hang Vick. You have websites dedicated to the bad athlete syndrome, quote unquote, you know. Like playersmisbehavingbadly.com and badjocks.com. You have various types from feminists on down the line saying that, you know, players that are involved in spousal abuse, and other people who are saying that players who are involved in fighting, you know, off the field, who get in trouble in these issues off of the field, should not be allowed to play on the field. So they're calling for punishment on the field for what's done off the field. And often, as we know, this is racialized and playing into the public's racialized response. It creates and promotes also the illusion that pro sports isn't what it is. Big market business. High profile with high profile-ism and special privileges. Now, the owners of these teams and the league and all of that, they don't look the other way, quote unquote, from players' conduct because they respect them. It's because the players make money for the league, so they make money off of them. When a certain player's image is tainted to a certain degree, they'll drop them as quick as a team will drop an injured player. Big sponsorship contracts right now are dropping like flies. Also, you have a situation where the punishment in the arena of football or sports in general is in part symbolism, because it allows the team and the league to present the image of cleaning itself up. And one, this is encoded in a racialized form of discipline, but two, it moves away from the reality that the big market system is something that's vulgar and dirty within itself. Here's an example of what I mean. There's been a number of reports and studies that have come out about how retired football players suffer early deaths and severe physical limitations. A while ago, of course, the American public doesn't care about that because they're disposable once they leave the field. But a while ago, an NFL doctor who worked for the Raiders wrote a book about his experiences And he talked about how one of the things that was contradictory within this market system of professional sports is that when you're a sports doctor, the team wants you to get the player back onto the field as soon as possible, even though that often contradicts the best interests in the short and long term, especially the long term, of the player's health. And he described how in one incident where he told a player who had been pretty racked up in a game that that's it, you're done for the day, don't go back in. Only minutes later, seeing the player start to run back on the field, he was so worried about the player's health that he literally ran out into the field and started to tackle the player because he was fearful that if the player suffered another injury, especially to his head in that particular game, so soon after he had already suffered a pretty severe injury, he could easily die. When he later brought the player over to the field, onto the sideline, he said, what are you doing? I told you you're out for the day. And he said, well, the coach tapped me on the shoulder and said, you're all right, go back in. Now, what this does is it helps expose the whole market aspect. Most likely, the coach was getting pressure from the owner saying, why is so-and-so not in the game? Get him back in the game. We pay him to get into the game, you know, disregard of the fact that a doctor said, no more playing today. You know, the player's just a commodity. But see, this is how these types of issues are often ignored, and how the market force within the system of the game distorts human life. But if you just racialize it into certain activities and knucklehead behavior off the court, especially when it's certain players, you can give the image that the game is quote-unquote pure. So the guidelines of what is pure about the game has nothing to do with these aspects that are instrumental and institutional within the system. Also, the team doctor noted that the teams get hospitals to be basically the team's hospital for the year. So the hospitals bid on the various teams. And often it's very prestigious for a team to have the Oakland Raiders or the Giants or whatever team, you know, to be their official team hospital. So they often bid very low because you have to outbid the other hospitals to get the contract. And by outbidding them means you bid the lowest. But what that does is often these hospitals are underbidding to get the contract. And football is a very brutal sport. And often you end up paying more for the treatment of the players than you did for your bid. So you're actually losing money. So once you get these contracts, one, there's pressure from the authorities to get these players back on the field and not treat them as much as possible, tell them they're okay, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, once again, by the management of the team, they want the players back on the field. So a player who should be out maybe a month and a half may be out 3 weeks or 2 weeks because you have all these conflicting pressures to get this player back onto the field as soon as possible. See, this is the brutality of the market order within big business sports and big business in general. But if you just reflect upon the Bonds action, the Bonds issue, Michael Vick, etc., etc., then you can help distort and give the illusion that the forces of market principles at the core are what is most hideous about what's going on in the playing field. So while these demented hypocrites scream about the brutality of these pro athletes and how more punishment for them is needed and needs to be meted out, it plays into the backwards class understanding and class human divide, often on racialized terms, in America. Now, often you hear this kind of mantra, we the public, even though they don't say it like, you know, we the white public, but often it's we the public need to be protected from these players and their conduct. in our kids, you know, things like that. And, you know, because look what's happening with steroids. Never mind that most of the high school students that use steroids, it turns out, they're not even athletes, male or female. It's the Arnold Schwarzenegger syndrome. It's the trying to, quote unquote, look as good as possible. So it's a physical appearance type of thing that we know is epidemic. I mean, hell, at least 40% of teenage girls, by the time they're 15, have gone on some diet. And we're talking about the ones that don't need to go on diets and stuff. So there's we have a society that's obsessed with appearance. And this goes beyond what's taking place on the athletic field. So all of these aspects, though, when you hear this mantra about our kids need to be protected, we need to be protected from these players' actions off the field and all of that, this all has racialized implications. Players are turned into the others. They're not reflective of the people who work, who labor within the market system of professionalized sports. Yet just because it's sports, it doesn't mean that it's not one big business and that these players are not laborers within, you know, they're entertainment laborers, but they have to use their physical abilities within this market matrix if they are going to generate any money. So often, just like in the larger social issues of these types of bonds, Vic issues, this not only then serves, when you see all of this rambling on and on about the athletes, it not only serves as a distraction, but helps unify the important elements in America as they stand united in denunciation of such quote-unquote immoral behavior, and remind sports fans who the proper enemies are, just like in the larger great American experiment. In other words, it allows the rulers, the big business, the elite, to have people focusing in on the Mike Vicks of the world instead of the Walmarts, instead of the giant stadiums that are bulldozing through your neighborhood. And often, creates a situation where the racialized other is your real quote-unquote enemy. Stu Bykoski. To save America, we need another 9/11. This is his article. 1 month from the anniversary, I was thinking another 9/11 would help America. What kind of sick bastard would write such a thing? A bastard so sick of how splintered we are politically, thanks mainly to our ineptitude in Iraq. Let me stop right there. Our ineptitude? In other words, he's combining the elite's ineptitude with the whole of the population. You know, it's not the rulers, it's our ineptitude. We all have a common agenda against the enemy, the Arabs in that region. Continuing. Thanks mainly to our ineptitude in Iraq that we have forgotten who the real enemy is. Who the real enemy is. Never mind that maybe some people are realizing that the enemy may be those in power, not someone thousands of miles away. That those who are involved in domestic spying and indefinite deterrent, torture, rendering, who are part of the elite order politics, maybe they're the enemy, but no, not to this clown. Quote, it is not Bush, and it is not Hillary, and it is not the Daily Coast or Bill O'Reilly or Giuliani or Barack. It's a global terrorist. It is global terrorists who use Islam to justify their hideous sins, including blowing up women and children. Hold on, let me stop. What about the terrorists who use white phosphorus, depleted uranium, counterinsurgency programs, divide and conquer with genocidal consequences to achieve their Salvadorian solutions? No, once again, we must keep our eyes on who they describe as our real enemies, as Stu Bykoski says, similar to how the sports game is played out, who the quote-unquote real enemy is. Continuing on, Iraq has fractured the U.S. into jigsaw pieces of competing interests and encourages our enemies. We are deeply divided, and divisions is weakness. Most Americans today believe Iraq was a mistake. Why? Not because Americans are anti-war. Americans have turned their back because the war has dragged on too long, and we don't have the patience for a long slog. We have been in Iraq for 4 years, but to some it seems like a century. In contrast, Britain just pulled the soldiers out of Northern Ireland, where they have been, often being shot at, almost 40 years. So never mind imperialism. Never mind occupation of other people's land. We should just stay the course and believe the mantra through learned allegiance who the quote-unquote enemy is. This is how sick these clowns are. But this is how, in many ways, the whole issue of sports is generated, of this racialized us versus them, through jealousy, envy, hypocrisy, internal hatred, etc., etc. Now, skipping down, the fool starts to go into this stuff about, because we have mislaid 9/11, we have endless sideshow squabbles about where the surge is working, if we are safer, quote-unquote, now, whether the FBI should listen in on foreign phone calls. They're doing more than foreign phone calls, fool. Whether cops should detain odd-acting flying imams. Whether those plotting alleged attacks on Fort Dix or Kennedy Airport are serious threats or amateur bumblers. We bicker over the trees while the forest is ablaze. America fabric is pulling apart like a cheap sweater. No, the dollar imperialism game is falling apart. What would sew us back together? Another 9/11 attack. In other words, more murder by the empire. More devastating. Devastation. That's how the game is played out. Moving down. Is there any doubt they are planning to hit us again? Who, the Bush gang? I mean, this is sick. But this is what this fool is writing. Continuing. If it is to be, then let it be. If it is to be, then let it be. In other words, kill more people in America for the course of empire. Continuing. It will take another attack on the homeland to quell the chattering of chipmunks and to restore America's righteous rage and singular purpose to prevail. Chattering of chipmunks. In other words, challenging empires is lies of 9/11. Questioning torture is chipmunk chattering to this savage. The unity bought by such an attack sadly won't last forever, though. The first 9/11 proved that. Well, in other words, metaphorically, what he's also saying, if you can translate it into the sports arena, well, we'll need more Mike Vick cases in the future to distract and to engage certain racialized portions of the population to attack who their to-be-learned enemy is. Because within the construct of whiteness, which is an elite order within itself, whether you are poor white or not, you know who your real enemies are. Now, it's also fascinating that, you know, the owner of the LA Clippers has many black basketball players on his team, but he's a very wealthy man, and the same owner of the LA Clippers has just had to settle another case where he was discriminating against blacks and Latinos in his rental housing in the area. In other words, they make concessions where they need black labor. And in the case of basketball, as being an owner, he knows he needs black basketball players. But it doesn't mean that he still doesn't have the venom of hatred and racist plague that courses through his body, and that he does not play it out in those ways. So from the owners to many fans, the song stays the same. Now staying with this item on this issue of black athletes and our pathological behavior towards violence, let's listen in on a conversation between a liberal talk show host, Jon Stewart, and a right-wing neocon, Bill Kristol, on Stewart's Daily Show as they discuss the issue of Iraq. Check this out.
My guest tonight is the editor of the Weekly Standard. Please welcome back to the program, Bill Kristol. Bill! Nice to see you.
Good to be here, John.
Welcome back to the fifth or sixth edition of Two Jews Disagreeing.
I can't recall. I can't recall anything
you
anymore.
You can't recall. It is viral. It is communicative, I tell you. Obviously, you and I have differing views on Iraq. You have just been to Iraq. You've spent, how long were you there?
About 8 days.
8 days. I assume it was to check on the surge.
It was, yeah, to find out what's going on, try to learn for myself.
And you have found, and I'm just going to go out on a limb here, it's all going well. Am I right?
Yeah.
I am right. What do you think?
It is going well.
It is going well.
It is going well. It's going badly in 2005 and 2006. One of the most striking things is talking to the soldiers.
Yeah.
I mean, how their morale is high because we now have a serious strategy which is being executed down the line and is succeeding. Now, it's late. The war's been 2 or 3 years. A lot of damage was done. It's a tough situation, but things are better than they were in January.
Here's what now, I obviously have been against the war from the start. Didn't think it was a very good idea. How, if it doesn't go well, if it continues to go badly, how will that be my fault?
It will be your fault if we pull the plug on a strategy that is now working. We finally have a good commander.
This is interesting to me.
No, I'm being serious, though. Look,
no, I know.
I said somewhere the other, about a month ago, I don't really blame the voters for electing a Democratic Congress in 2006, much as I felt much like a Democratic Congress, because
right.
Bush and Rumsfeld had so mismanaged the war that it was a reasonable reaction to say we need to send a message. Bush took the message that we fired Rumsfeld, he brought Petraeus in, they're running a serious counterinsurgency, and it is working.
Can you see how someone who is skeptical, basically we're hearing from people like yourself, people like the president, trust us to undo the terrible thing we did. Don't trust me.
Well, trust skeptics of the war, like Michael Hamlin and Ken Pollack, who went over, who've been there before, who came back.
Skeptics. No, absolutely, they were.
Who came back and had seen it in real time.
Ken Pollack would like us to invade Iran, for God's sakes. I mean,
no.
Those are two very hawkish guys.
It's not a bad idea. Or trust other people. Trust even Democratic Congress or the Trump. Look, things are getting better. That's our point.
No, seriously.
Now that is, look,
well,
that is don't trust me, but look, the president, and don't trust President Bush. On the other hand, he's the president. We have to make a serious decision. We let General Petraeus play this out for the next 6 months, and we pull the plug on it next month. That's the practical decision.
It's not a matter of trusting. That's the part I'm having trouble figuring out. What's the end game?
Increased security. Uh-huh. The Sunni areas, which are flipped against Al-Qaeda, are now becoming pretty stable, and I think we have a pretty good shot in Anbar and elsewhere at a reasonably stable situation
but
there.
But Anbar is not the surge. That's a different place. The surge is Baghdad.
No. We added actually an important brigade into Anbar, which cleaned out Ramadi, and we walked around Ramadi, and it's pretty amazing what's happened there. Baghdad is very difficult and complicated. We are making progress there. But don't trust anyone. I mean, you just have to make a serious decision going forward. Things are getting better. No one doubts that. The question is, are they getting better enough?
Right.
And can we end up in an acceptable end state where there's enough security that we don't have a terror state?
Why the anger towards people that were against the war? I'm trying to wrap my head around, and I read the editorials, the vitriol that's heaped on people that were against the war seems so misplaced to me. This idea of, like, they're defeatists, they're cut and runners, they don't understand the threat. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I don't think I'm angry at people who were against the war. I am angry at people who would pull the plug now.
If you call someone a defeatist and a cut and runner who is making it so that they don't support the troops, would you say that's anger?
No, I would say if you... Look, some people think Harry Reid said, we have lost the war. Is it fair to call him a defeatist? What is he saying? He's saying we've been defeated and we should acknowledge it and get out.
But you said Sunni and Shia would get along. You've said a lot of things that if we went back and picked through, I could say to you,
right.
Should I call you terrible names? No, of course not. You're just the simple fellow who's devised a plan that the president executed.
But my point is this.
I've been...
Why isn't it...
One thing you've said is you feel like President Bush has been a steadfast leader.
Yeah, he's been mistaken about something.
But where has he displayed leadership?
Getting with this war when it was unpopular, and I think he was right.
I know where he's displayed stubbornness. Where is he? Isn't leadership bringing along a country and not chastising those who disagree and making them feel like pussies?
And no, I don't think he's ever...
He does!
No. He's never made you feel like a pussy. I've talked to the president about you, and I want to assure you. He told me to tell you this. He does not consider you a pussy.
Where do you go? Where does he go?
He's showing leadership now, which is he is making a case for sustaining the surge. I think he's making it responsibly. He's not demagoguing the issues. To say this is a nonpartisan general. He will come back in September.
Trust the trash. If we get the security down, then they build a democracy, and then that flourishes and spreads throughout, like pretty flowers throughout the Middle East.
And then, I think they could have a decent regime there, which would have an effect elsewhere in the Middle East. But certainly, if you cannot go there and talk to our soldiers and talk to the Iraqi army soldiers and hear the stories of what Al-Qaeda does and hear the stories of what the Shia militias do,
and then say,
just cavalierly, it's ludicrous, we're not doing any good there. We are doing a lot of good.
Nobody
there.
Says we're not doing any good. Here's what they say, honestly. And this is what I think if the president would say, he'd do a lot better with people. They say Al-Qaeda and terrorism were a huge threat. And going into Iraq was a big mistake that diverted our resources from that actual fight. And as you see them become resurgent in Afghanistan and in that area of Pakistan, and by not acknowledging that is, when I speak of that arrogance, it is hard for people to get past original sin. It's hard for people to get past it. And a real leader...
We don't believe in original sin. I mean, I think they're doing their best. Let's see what General Petraeus and Ambassador Pryor say in September. And they will convince you, and you will be sustaining...
Have you talked to General Petraeus?
I saw him when I was over there.
Yeah. Will he come and sit on the program?
He thinks you're a pussy.
That's the best line I've heard in a very long time. We'll be right back. That's the best.
Now, what's fascinating about that conversation from a slave perspective, and I know, let me tie it together, because I know many were thinking, you know, what am I playing this for in the context of sports, imagery, propaganda, war, etc., etc. But it's quite fascinating how you had these two guys get together. And this show was a little while ago. And what they were basically doing, if you heard like Stewart first talking to Crystal saying how Bush is, you know, making us feel like a pussy. And then Crystal responded back. Bush doesn't consider you a pussy. And then later he mentioned how this other general or whatever wouldn't talk to him because he does think that Stewart's a pussy. What they're basically doing is using women's anatomy to symbolize in the context of war what is strong, what is soft, what is weak. In this, the women become reduced to an anatomy. The vagina. That represents soft. This is those who are weak, who want to pull out. Crystal, Bush in them represent the strong, hard, white penis that's going to stay the course. It's going to penetrate in whether you want it to or not. And after all, the mighty white penis is designed to penetrate into the penis and penetrate their land. Iraqis are nothing more than pussies themselves within this context. They don't have a right to or a say if they're going to be violated or not. the penis decides where it's going to penetrate, how long it's going to stay in, when it's going to leave. And as far as these white male penises like Bill Crystal are concerned, they're going to stay in until they ejaculate out their DNA in the form of white phosphorus, in the form of imperial genocide, depleted uranium, in the form of economic and political control. Because that's what hard white penises do within the imperial context. But if this had been some little athletes talking in the locker room, or some little, you know, Negro rappers talking, it would have been seen as vulgar, reducing women into body parts and symbolizing them as weak, soft, you know, not being able to stay the course, you know. they want to pull out, you know. That's what pussies do. The hard, erect, white, imperial penises, they don't ask questions. They kick ass and take names later. And it's quite fascinating that on this liberal show, the audience laughed. There was no outcry from any, vagina monologue women activist types, because in the context of who was saying, it wasn't what they were saying and how they were connecting it to imperial war, how they were connecting women's private parts into imperial war of weak versus strong. It wasn't what they were saying, it was who was saying it. So from a liberal talk show host to a conservative neocon, they can reduce women into their little private anatomies and not fear any reprisal whatsoever, and not be condemned in the same context that black athletes or black people in general, which is the whole point of what I'm saying. I'm not saying that there is not barbaric and silly actions going on. I'm not saying, of course, that there is not male hierarchical patriarchal dominance that's running amok within this society. But it becomes obvious that there is a sham being played on all of us when there's only certain times and certain elements of the population when this type of outrage towards violence or whatever is expressed in the real world. Yet this coincides with the elite mindset of domination and penetration, regardless of where one is in the world, by the imperial market supremacist forces or those regardless of one's age. Here's what I mean. By Robert Capps, Salon Magazine, June 26, 2002. Ben Johnson recalled in horror when he heard one of his fellow helicopter mechanics at a U.S. Army base near Tulsa, Bosnia, brag one day in early 2000, quote, "My girls, not a day over 12, unquote. The man who uttered the statement, a man in his 60s by Johnson's estimate, was not talking fondly about his granddaughter or daughter or another relative. He was bragging about the preteen he had purchased from a local brothel. Johnston, who'd gone to work as a civilian contract mechanic for Dyne Corps Incorporated after a six-year stint in the Army, had worked on helicopters for years, and he heard a lot of hangar talk, but never anything like this. More and more, often in those months, the talk among his co-workers had turned to boast about owning prostitutes. Owning prostitutes. How young they were, how good they were in bed, how much they cost, and it wasn't just boasting. Johnston often saw co-workers out on the streets of Dubrave, the closest town to the base, with the young female consorts that inspired their braggadocios. They'd bring them to company functions, and on one occasion, Johnston says, over to his house for dinner, Occasionally he see the young girls riding bikes and playing with other children, with their owners, quote-unquote, standing by watching. But the bragging about a 12-year-old sex slave pushed Johnston over the edge. Quote, "I had to do something," unquote, he says. There were kids involved. Let me stop right there. I'm going to deal with this more in-depthly on a separate slave show. But this is about dying poor sex slaves. This is about a bunch of white men in these powerful corporations owning sex slaves, little girls, buying them, buying brothels. DynCorp is a subsidiary of Halliburton. It gets government contracts, taxpayer-based contracts, corporate welfare, at cost plus issues. Now, this broke out a while ago. No outcry, by and large, by the American population. No outcry of the human suffering and super exploitation of not just women, little girls. But once again, through learned indifference, learned obedience, and learned allegiance, when its powerful corporate elites engaged in this type of activity, hey, people know when to speak out and when to shut the hell up. Now, this Salon magazine online article, like I said, by Robert Katz, is called Outside the Law. And it was written June 26, 2002. Yet on C-SPAN, March 11, 2005, one of three interesting topics came up when Cynthia McKenzie, at the House hearing of the FY06, with Rumsfeld, Myers, Hunter, Jones, under question by the representative, brought this to the fore.
Mr. Secretary, I watched President Bush deliver a moving speech at the United Nations in September 2003, in which he mentioned the crisis of the sex trade. The president called for the punishment of those involved in this horrible business. But at the very moment of that speech, DynCorp was exposed for having been involved in the buying and selling of young women and children. While all of this was going on, DynCorp kept the Pentagon contract to administer the smallpox and anthrax vaccines and is now working on a plague vaccine through the Joint Vaccine Acquisition Program. Mr. Secretary, is it policy of the U.S. government to reward companies that traffic in women and little girls? That's my first question. My second question, Mr. Secretary, according to the Comptroller General of the United States, there are serious financial management problems at the Pentagon, to which Mr. Cooper alluded. Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. And DOD is the number one reason why the government can't balance its checkbook. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other. My second question, Mr. Secretary, is who has the contract today to make those systems communicate with each other? How long have they had those contracts? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them? Finally, Mr. Secretary, after the last hearing, I thought that my office was promised a written response to my question regarding the four war games on September 11th. I have not yet received that response, but would like for you to respond to the questions that I've put to you today, and then I do expect the written response to my previous question, hopefully by the end of the week.
Thank you, Representative. The answer to your first question is no, absolutely not. The policy of the United States government is clear, unambiguous, and opposed to the activities that you described. The second question.
Well, how do you explain the fact that DynCorp and its successor companies have received and continue to receive government contracts?
I would have to go and find the facts but there are laws and rules and regulations with respect to government contracts. And there are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that the under the laws and the rules and regulations for the that passed by the Congress and implemented by the executive branch, that corporations can get off of out of the penalty box, if you will, and be permitted to engage in contracts with the government. They're not generally not barred in perpetuity.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
The second question, I've forgotten what the second question was.
I think Ms. Jonas knows it.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. McKinney. I appreciate the question. I appreciate your interest in our department's financial condition. And we are working very hard on that program. I've just come back recently.
I understand that you're working hard on it, but my question was, who has the contract? How long have they had that contract? And how much money have we spent on it?
In general, we spend about $20 billion in the Department on Information Technology Systems. The accounting systems are part of that. I can get you the exact number for the record of what we spend on our current, what we call legacy systems. And those that we're moving towards.
And who has the contracts?
That would be a multitude of individuals.
Could you name some, please?
Well, I think off the top of my head, well, I would rather not. I'd rather provide that for the record.
That's not privileged information, is it?
I'm sure it's not.
Well, please. We still have time, so please.
I would be glad to provide for the record. I don't want to talk from the top of my head.
Hello.
Once again, we can see how learned allegiance, learned outrage, learned aggression is played out. Here, DynCorp, they basically got away. And here, they were still receiving governmental contracts, taxpayer expense, in 2005. Even though the case had broken out years ago and had been exposed. Cynthia McKenzie calls Rumsfeld on it, and Rumsfeld comes with these responses, no, we don't approve of these actions, it's not acceptable and all of that, but they're still receiving the contracts. No penalty whatsoever. Now, this was something that was happening on the playing field. In other words, they were exploiting women on the playing field, on the war field, as disaster capitalists of the Imperial Order. This wasn't something that people were doing off. This was while they were having these contracts and the corporation was deeply involved in the exploitation of women at taxpayer expense and at human expense of little girls. No outcry. No major situation, firestorm in America. This is a population that's so beat down that they only look towards certain issues and people, issues within the sports arena, certain racialized groups, to express their outrage because of their learned indifference to the truly barbaric actions and nature of this wretched society. And what's even sicker is people like Ben Johnston and others have been disciplined for coming out and being whistleblowers, which brings up another topic. You know, in other words, when you snitch against the state, when you snitch against the corporations, then you are punished. You know, because like, one of the things that has come out concerning like Vic and other things and Bonds issue in a larger black community is the issue of snitching. Cam'ron, the little Negro rapper, is commenting on snitching. Now, we in the black community know that the biggest snitches are the thugs, the drug dealers, the pimps, the hustlers themselves. They work with cops all the time and snitching on each other and snitching on any kind of issue that the cops want to know about. They play informant all the time, the little punks. You know, so they've worked historically and currently with the little punk-ass cops to destroy groups like the Panthers. Because in many ways, they have a common objective. One, the cops and those who are rulers of the cops don't want to see any kind of vibrant development organizing within the community. Because then that's when you have the community and the various organizations, federations, collectives challenging the authority of the state. So they want to suppress that and disorganize that as much as possible. By the same token, the little drug dealers and hustlers, since they're parasites on the community, they don't want to see a strong, healthy, vibrant community, because a strong, healthy, vibrant community has immunity towards these parasites. Collectives and organizations are penicillin to these little punk-ass thugs. So they want to see as much chaos and self-destructiveness as possible, like their puppet master cops. So this is where you often see these two elements parallel one another. So you have that aspect going on. But the snitching thing, from the state's standpoint, serves many real objectives that the thugs can care less about. One, it creates distrust amongst your neighbors so that you won't organize with them. No one trusts one another, which is what the thugs really want. They want the community polarized so they can prey. Another aspect is the snitching aspect is designed to create fear of a larger, like Big Brother state apparatus, as they spy on every aspect of your life, legally and illegally. You know, the FBI, Alberto Gonzalez, have all been found to be illegally spying on American citizens' personal information. A March 9th probe found that FBI agents for 3 years were engaged in this illegal activity, from telephone to internet records, getting personal information, and that this was also underreported to Congress. Yet these demons want us to trust and cooperate with them in their global terrorizing network, internally and externally.
Do you know a terrorist? Not long ago, this would have seemed like a ridiculous question, but not anymore. The United States government is offering rewards of up to $25 million for information that prevents an international terrorist act against U.S. persons or property, or brings to justice persons who have committed one. To date, more than $8 million has been paid. Stop and think about it. Information about suspicious activities involving aircraft, about stolen explosives or biological materials, about letters or packages. It all could add up to preventing a terrorist act. Now do something about it. Call Rewards for Justice at 1-800-US-REWARDS. 1-800-US-REWARDS. Or email us at mail@rewardsforjustice.net. You may be eligible for a reward. Your call or email will remain confidential. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of State.
So once again, they want us to be an apparatus to a false war that's really a war on us, but it's disguised as something for our safety. That's the same thing that's going on with this war on drugs. But when you have knucklehead, you know, clowns like Cameron and other buffoons trying to talk about the issue, it's easily distorted out into, you know, kind of a self-nihilism type of game. Now, in the context of sports, of course, they applauded and grinned ear to ear as Vic's friends started to a snitch on him about the dogfighting issue. But they're angry at Bonds' friend, who has not been forthcoming on information that the state feels that it needs to basically crush Bonds over the steroid issue. So basically, they're just keeping him locked up until he tells them what they want him to tell. So this is how the whole quote-unquote snitch thing and informant thing is basically a tool and apparatus for the state, and how it's used for their particular interests. It's not anything to do with our safety or anything like that, but it often becomes racialized in the same way that sports issues of snitching, violence, et cetera, are racialized and expressed by much of the population in anger when it's certain portions of the population engaged in. So here you have a situation where in the real world, while many are angry with Bonds' friend for not quote-unquote snitching on him and doing the right thing, quote-unquote, how does it play out, this myth of America in its purity, and how the empire really is in the real world, when a whistleblower decided that she needed to come out with some information about some problems going on that she saw? Article, August 24th, 2007. Deborah Hastings, Associated Press. Whistleblower on fraud facing penalties. One after another, the men and women who have stepped forward to report corruption in the massive effort to rebuild Iraq have been vilified, fired, and demoted, or worse. For daring to report illegal arms sales, Navy veteran Donald Vance says he was imprisoned by the American military in a security compound outside Baghdad and subjected to harsh interrogation methods. Let me stop. In other words, he snitched on the state and corporate elite, so he's being punished for it. Continuing, there were times huddled on the floor in solitary confinement with that head banging, music blaring, drawn to dust, and interrogators yelling the same question over and over, that Vance began to wish he had just kept his mouth shut. Let me stop. In other words, don't snitch on the state or the corporate elite. You can snitch and make up whatever you want on each other, but don't challenge the state. Quote, continuing on. He had thought he was doing a good and noble thing when he started telling the FBI about the guns and landmines and rocket launchers, all of them being sold for cash, no receipts necessary, he said. He told a federal agent the buyers were Iraqi insurgents, American soldiers, State Department workers, and Iraqi embassy and ministry employees. The seller, he claimed, was the Iraqi-owned company he worked for, Shield Group Security Corporation. Quote, it was a Walmart for guns, he says. It was all illegal and everyone knew it, unquote. So Vance said he blew the whistle, supplying photos and documents and other intelligence to the FBI agent in his hometown of Chicago because he didn't know whom to trust in Iraq. For his trouble, he says he got 97 days in Camp Cropper, an American military prison outside Baghdad that once held Saddam Hussein, and he was classified a security detainee. Also held was former colleague Nathal Ertel, who helped Vance gather evidence documenting the sales, according to a federal lawsuit both had filed in Chicago, alleging they were illegally imprisoned and subjected to physical and mental interrogation tactics, quote, reserved for terrorists and so-called enemy combatants, unquote. In other words, not all snitching is acceptable snitching. If you snitch against certain people who are tied within the intelligence apparatus of U.S. military imperial goals, in corporate interests, whether they're the SHIELD group out of Iraq, which is tied to the whole intelligence apparatus of what America is doing, or whether you are some little pimp, slave, flesh peddler owner for DynCorp, the song remains the same. Keep your mouth shut. Don't snitch on the elite. Moving down on the article, it says, despite this staggering mess, there are noble outcomes for those who have blown the whistle, according to a review of such cases by the Associated Press. If you do it, you will be destroyed, unquote, said William Weaver, professor of political science at the University of Texas, El Paso, a senior advisor to the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. In other words, if you snitch, they'll destroy you. Quote, Reconstruction is so rife with corruption. Sometimes people ask me, should I do this? And my answer is no. If they're married, they'll lose their family. They will lose their jobs. They will lose everything, unquote, Weaver said. They have been fired or demoted, shunned by colleagues, and denied by government support in whistleblower lawsuits filed against contracting firms. Quote, the only way we can find out what is going on is for someone to come forward and let us know, unquote, said Beth Daly of the Project on Government Oversight, an independent nonprofit group that investigates corruption. Quote, but when they do, the weight of the government comes down on them. The message is, don't blow the whistle or we'll make your life hell, unquote. In other words, don't snitch on the government, the elites, the corporations, and its corporate intelligence affiliates, or you'll be crushed. And if you are unwilling to snitch, quote unquote, like Bond's friend, then you'll be crushed. But it all looks different through racialized lenses in the world, which is quite fascinating because, like, in many ways, the true resistance of black history knows how this stuff is played out. I'm not talking about some knucklehead with a mic in front of his mouth who thinks he has some sense because he can put a couple of rhymes together. The reality is that if one examines the Wayne Williams case, one sees how the snitch game plays itself out. Wayne Williams was convicted of two murders, one an adult, another a kid. He's been associated with the murders of the Atlanta child murders, where there was over 30 murders. In reality, he killed no one. They framed him up. But a fascinating thing happened. The black community in Atlanta started to lose confidence in the police and the administration. So they started to form their own self-defense squads. Women would go out with walkie-talkies whenever they were alone and have instant communiques with other black people in the community. The police and the various administrations in Atlanta began to worry about this type of networking. At the same time, they had their own informants infiltrate various groups. One of the groups that their informants infiltrated was the Klan, and they found that the Klan was involved in many of the killings and actually had taped conversations of the Klansmen plotting, targeting, and carrying out the killings. But this type of information was considered dangerous by the administration because they didn't want the black community armed with the fact that the Klan and Klan type people were targeting their own people. So they withheld the snitch information from the informants and withheld the documents and the tape recordings, framed up Wayne Williams and cast him off into prison, which he still is in today. In other words, all snitch, quote-unquote, information isn't treated equally. Take the Central Park jogging case. Remember I did that whole show called "The Central Fascism in America Will Be As Simple as a Jog in a Park," the Central Park jogging case, which basically the five teenagers, out of the five teenagers, four were broken down to snitch on one another, snitch on themselves and one another. in the police fabricated story that they brutalized and raped this Central Park jogger. It was all made up. It was all coerced. And they've all been exonerated. Martius Reyes, who was an adult at the time, was the lone rapist and brutalizer of the Central Park jogging victim. But the one thing that Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld asked for in the Innocence Project, that they turn on the camera through the whole interrogation. If it takes 20 hours, turn it on for 20 hours. Don't just turn it on in the last 10, 20 minutes when you've broken them down through various barbaric tricks and measures and stuff. But this would undermine the process of how they get these guys to snitch on one another and themselves, even though their snitches are their snitching is based in lies. So guess what? In New York, they still don't require by law people to film the whole interrogation process. As a matter of fact, only in Minnesota and Alaska is the whole filming of the interrogation process mandatory by law. In other words, certain snitching is acceptable and certain snitching is not. But if you want to be a Negro snitcher or one who doesn't snitch, and you want to make a career out of yourself and actually be held in high esteem by many people, become a Colin Powell type. Colin Powell got his career started off with the May Lai Massacre. He went over to May Lai. This is where U.S. G.I. Joes were throwing little babies in the air in the village, machine gunning them into little pieces, raping women. You know, traditional American value Christian stuff. Colin Powell got the information and kept his mouth closed. He didn't snitch on the barbarity, even though he was supposed to investigate the barbarity of his fellow G.I. Joes. And his career has been bliss ever since. In other words, once again, certain snitching is acceptable and certain snitching isn't. But it all comes across different in this racialized lens of America. Even Scooter Libby, convicted thug, cover-up, CIA, or, you know, the whole CIA Valerie Plame, plane leak case, was rewarded by Boy George Bush for not snitching on the information he had when Boy George commuted his sentence. In other words, since Libby did a good job in keeping his mouth closed, not snitching, he was rewarded. Now, here's how this case is interpreted by right-wingers like Karen Hadrity on the Chris Matthews Hardball Show.
Welcome back to Hardball. More on that wide-ranging news conference held by the president today. Karen Hadrity writes for The Hill. That's the newspaper they read on Capitol Hill. And Ezra Klein writes for The American Prospect. A couple of interesting things today. First of all, the president was asked about Scooter Libby. He called him Lewis Libby. We all know him as Scooter Libby, his former assistant, former chief assistant to the vice president, convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice. He gave him clemency. The president said he denied having given the guy a break. He said he's already been punished. What does he mean by that, Karen? I don't get it. If you get off scot-free, people go to jail for, you know, traffic violations longer than this guy went.
Well, look, Scooter Libby isn't off completely scot-free. No, he's not going to serve any time. But
what is he going to do?
He will be disbarred. If he hasn't been disbarred,
what's his punishment?
Well, he's lost a career. He's got public humiliation.
He'll be on a think tank in three days.
He'll be skipping doodad over to the American Enterprise Institute and become a senior fellow immediately.
You say you don't think that
I'm asking. You think he got off?
Well, I'm answering.
If I go to Lorton Prison across the river, I go to Sing Sing, and I say you're out the door, everybody would say you gave me a break.
He's been publicly humiliated.
And he has this on his record for the rest of his life.
But he's a hero in the conservative movement to the conservative press. There's nobody who believes.
Are you part of the conservative movement?
I've read the National Review. They adore him. You really don't believe he will be hard up for a job.
Conservative movement, first of all.
Should the president use his last 2 hours in office to pardon him, to make a complete clean break for the guy?
don't...
Or city or Sydney.
I don't really... He can or he can't.
Well, what do you think he should do? You're a citizen.
Can.
What do you think he should do? Let the guy go, erase his all his problems, let him back be a lawyer again?
I'll tell you what, you have to look at the president's words. And here's why I don't think
should
he will.
Should this guy practice law again?
If he's pardoned, absolutely.
Well, should he be pardoned?
I don't think he will be pardoned. And here's what...
Should
here's
he
what,
I don't, are you guys incapable of an answer? You're pardoned.
Well,
if you're advising the president, would you advise him to pardon him or not?
At the end of the term?
Yeah, that was watching.
Yeah, probably.
So you don't think he should pay any price?
If
he'll be back practicing law, he'll be clean as a whistle, they'll be making him a hero at the American Enterprise Institute. He'll be one of the neoconservative heroes of the year. In other words, you want to completely get him, let him go.
He can go, he cannot go. It doesn't matter to the conservative movement. Literally, he doesn't. You think he does. No,
I'm
you're inside the Beltway people. I'm telling you,
he was
President Bush's numbers show up when Iota, when he pardoned him.
The issue is critical. Not whether or not what happens to him puts Bush's numbers
up. No, but again, you know, another issue is that person, that's really what it's all about.
What he did was wrong. This is why we don't like George W. Bush.
He's getting clemency. He was a good soldier. He covered for a problem. He took the hit. It looks to me from the outside, that's what he did. He took the hit. He did all this stuff. He took all the hit for it. He never called the vice president in to testify. He never testified in his own behalf, which would have opened him up to pointing the finger at Bob. He was a good soldier. You know, in a certain way, I might, in theory, respect that, although I don't respect a lot of the shenanigans that went on. But clearly, he took the bullet. Ezra, your turn.
If I were...
The president said he suffered enough. It's over.
Let's pardon me, and make it honest. Let's just say... quite clearly, don't let him do this. He'll have it both ways. Oh, Sidoli is paying a price. Bush doesn't think he should pay that much a price. He'll second-guess the legal system. That's what say. He protected me. He protected Vice President Cheney. He was a good soldier, as you said.
He never asked him to testify. He could have called him the vice
president. He could have done anything
for him.
He could have done anything.
What made me do it?
Now, what's fascinating about this is that, Scooter Libby was getting a... was convicted and got a 30-month prison sentence. But Boy George commuted that sentence so he didn't have to serve any time. He was still a convicted felon with a $250,000 fine, which means nothing for him and his inklings. But you heard Karen Hanratty say that, he probably should be exonerated from that before Boy George leaves office. In other words, there should be no punishment for this person because of his loyalty to the Pentagon, the administration. But once again, just like we see many other things and how they are coded and how there is a learned response and anger towards certain portions of the population and a learned indifference when it comes from other elements. This plays, once again, right into it and shows the hypocrisy of this system. So while the Bonds haters are decrying Bonds' friend for not snitching on him and angry that Bonds may be paying off his friend when he gets out of jail for not snitching, Boy George does something that elevates well beyond the issue of Bond's alleged activity. And for the most part, it gets the nod of the approval from a populace that's engaged in learned indifference. Now, by and large, though, you've noticed that I didn't really address the Bonds issue so much or as directly as I could have as a whole. And there's various reasons that I'll explore right now. First of all, you know, you often hear people talk about hallowed records. And once again, that's part of the illusion of the American, you know, myth, especially within the confines of sports being the pure sanctuary. But Babe Ruth and other people from that particular era are often brought up as, you know, the greatest players and all of that. And we're supposed to put them in the mix. And I can go on and on about what was happening during Ruth's era and what he did to his body or attempted to do and all of that. But personally, it's always been irrelevant. And part of the reason is that back then, black people weren't allowed to play in the league. So it's really quite simple. If I don't count, you don't count. Why would I count an era that doesn't count me? That doesn't make any sense. Oh, what makes white people so special that I would count them in an era when they don't count me? I've never met any individual white person or any group of white people as a collective that would have me put them anywhere near a pedestal that I would count them in an era where I didn't count. If I don't count, you don't count. So it's all been irrelevant about these kind of historic periods and all of that when I'm excluded from that era. I mean, that's the real world. So I don't even waste my time going in about what, you know, what kind of pitches were allowed, what wasn't allowed. No, if I don't count during an era, you don't count. Sorry. That's the real world. But also, baseball is just the biggest fraud going, which ties into the big business, the corporate elites in general. It's all tied together. Because while Bonds has become the figurehead of steroids and steroid abuse and all of that, one of the reasons why I know it's racialized and how it's centralized on a key figure is that right now, baseball has banned two major substances, steroids and human growth hormones, both of which have obviously been prevalent in fairly recent years in baseball. Now, many people pretend that the game is cleaning itself out up, and all we need to do is get rid of Bonds, and we can get back to the purity of the game. But what's fascinating is that while these fools blather on like this, steroids, you can detect steroids through urine, but you can't detect human growth hormone through testing someone's urine. The only way to detect someone is using human growth hormones is to test their blood. But in baseball, they don't test for blood. So it's all a scam. There could be zillions of players out there using human growth hormone, and no one knows because they don't test for it. Not that I'm calling for it, for reasons you'll see why later, but it's all a sham. At the same time, while they blather on about steroids in the professional sports arena, many of us know about these pig cops who've been jacked up on roids and other drugs and have been going hog wild while abusing these types of drugs and have been in all kinds of altercations as they try to jack themselves up in an intimidation formation. Yet, you can't get any real response from the larger American public on pig cop abuse of steroids and other drugs. As a matter of fact, often when they gun you down, they allow the cops a couple of days to flush the drugs out of their system. So, in other words, baseball records are sacred, but not black lives. Now, go to hell. I ain't playing that game. But part of the core issue of this is that, in reality, this issue of steroids and drug use and sports and other things, in reality, is like a tale of two cities. And what I mean by that is that when Michael Jordan decided that he wanted to get into the profession of baseball and try to make money in a career out of baseball, he did it through the tradition of what many people like him who come from his particular background do it as. In other words, he took off his basketball shoes, put on his baseball cleats, and tried to make it in the field of dreams. If Jordan makes it or not depended on his physical skill level in baseball. Now, it turned out that Jordan's baseball skill was not up to par. So basically, Jordan took off the baseball cleats and put back on the basketball shoes. And when Jordan left baseball through his trials and tribulations in the sport, he left with no more money in his pocket from that game than he entered into it. That's how it works for those who have to use their labor in that sport, in other sports. But when Boy George Bush decided he wanted to get into the profession of baseball, he did it through the ways that people from his class background do. He became an owner. And by all accounts, Michael Jordan was a much better baseball player than Boy George was a baseball owner. Yet, when Boy George parachuted out of baseball, he parachuted out with millions in his pocket. In other words, what I'm in part saying is that there's no reason for the Boy Georges and people of his class to have to inject themselves with chemical enhancements like steroids to perform on their field of dreams. That's left for the laborers. So the whole thing is constructed for people who have a short-term history in a particular profession to exploit their themselves for their goals. Whereas people of Bush's class, they don't have to worry about that. Their steroids comes in the form of NAFTA, GATT, Imperial Wars, depleted uranium, white phosphorus, counterintelligence programs, PSYOPs operations, the School of the Americas. That's their steroids. AFRICOM, neocon programs, grand chessboard writings by the Brzezinskis, the chemical use and abuse of drugs to enhance one's ability, that's left up for the laborers, the slaves, the servants. Now, in reality, they don't care about steroid and roided type of abuse when it serves their purpose, because right now there's a 12-year-old girl somewhere in Latin America abusing herself by force through some kind of roided out treatment, some kind of amphetamine-ized treatment of drugs to keep her awake, to keep her alert, to keep her going 110 miles an hour, working on the same shoes that that the Jordans and the Bonds of the world wear in some Nike factory. Yet, they don't care when it's within those parameters, because at the end of the day, they don't care about the health of any of these people. It's about the illusion of purity, the illusion of the level playing field. What about the 12-year-old girl's health? It's all a scam. It's all a scam. Their roided out system, called the market system, called NAFTA, GATT. Where's the level playing field there? Where it crushes out human lives day by day. So in essence, no fool has a right to know even what's in my body. This is why I don't even make the steroid issue an issue. You don't have a right to know what's in my body. You don't want to know what's in my body when I come back full of Agent Orange from Vietnam. But you want to know what's in my body when I'm on some little baseball field. You don't want to know or care what's in my body when I come back full of toxins from the Gulf War I situation. But you want to know what's in my body when I'm on your super silly football field. You don't want to know what's in my body when I come back from this current imperial war. You don't want to test my blood when I come back from this current toxic stew of cancer-causing crisis in Iraq. But you want to know what's in my body when I play on the NBA plantation ground. No, the hell with that. The hell with that and the hell with you. You don't have a right to know what's in my body. This purity game is a sham. It's a scam. And it's a game I refuse to play. This pro sports phenomenon serves as a great illusion for the simple-minded American masses, where in this wretched society, their purity, fairness, equality, for how all those who participate in play by the rules of the elite in this big market enterprise plays itself out in this giant rabbit hole. But it's, at the end of the day, it's all a big business scam. Grow up and face it. So while NBA refs like Tim Donaghy get caught betting on games, and Homeland Security Department press secretaries like Brian Dole are found to trying to solicit sex from 14-year-old girls, and damn bridges are falling down in Minnesota, and Filipinos are being kidnapped and shipped to Iraq to work basically as slaves. Fools in America hover around the pro sports learned illusion and compliance, where they look through the world of pro sports as being the world that needs to be cleaned up for the good of humanity. That this is where there's purity and where purity belongs, without accepting the fact that it's a component of the market order. Yet pro sports helps keep people's heads in the rabbit hole, so deep that most can't even see it's simply in part a reflection of this larger order. Only the empire does more than kill dogs and bite off the heads of rabbits. It does much more than that. These elite, enslaved little girls burn alive human beings, rape the environment. But that's all right. Because in this world of learned allegiance and anger, much of this American population knows when to bark and when to heal better than any trained pet monkey or dog. Mike Vick ever owned. Hold on a sec. For related and unrelated slave programming. We're going to connect some more of these dots next week and see how far down the rabbit hole this society really is. So stay tuned as we explore more of this phenomenon, slave style, in this American and worldwide experiment. Until the next time, slave out.